listening to Heart of Mind Radio for the New Millennium. I'm Catherine Davis, and my guests today are Julia Mossbridge, PhD, and she is a scientist at IONS and the director of the IONS Innovation Lab. She is also a visiting scholar in the psychology department at Northwestern. Her research interests time and the conscious mind, intuition, dreaming, soundscape, influence on mood, and models of transformation and transcendence. And she is the co-author of The Premonition Code. And we're going to be talking about that in just a few moments. Also joining me is Mitchell Rabin. He's a holistic psychotherapist, life coach, stress management consultant, with a background in traditional Chinese acupuncture, and host of A Better World Radio and TV, environmentalist, social entrepreneur, and international speaker. And so we are going to be coming together in a conversation. We're very much interested in talking about this idea of the premonition code. So I want to welcome you, Julia, and Mitchell, to Heart of Mind.
Thanks so much. I'm happy to be here.
Yes, I'm very happy to have you, and thank you, Mitchell, for joining us as well.
Absolutely, Catherine. Great to be here with you again.
So what I would love to do is to start by talking about maybe, Mitchell, you can start briefly to talk to us about how you and Julia came together.
Well, sure, Catherine. I'm pleasure, Garth, being on your show again. I love your show. Yeah, it's actually funny how we came together because I know her colleague, Dean Radin, at the Institute of Noetic Sciences, and I've had Dean on the show several times and have visited him up in their beautiful place in Petaluma, California. But this came through an entirely different source. A fellow just shot me an email. I'm on the board of directors of the Friends of the Institute of Noetic Sciences here in New York. We support different IONS events and have our own in the same ilk of thinking, the same themes having to do with the work of Edgar Mitchell, actually, originally, the astronaut who came down from his trip to the moon and was playing different ESP games and tests with friends of his on the Earth to see if there could be communications telepathically between people that are in outer space, as we call it, of course, and people on the Earth. And he found, in fact, there was a higher probability of communication taking place than was supposed. And so when he came back to Earth, he began this thing called the Institute of Noetic Sciences, and I'm part of that branch in New York. So a fellow contacted me, a fellow named Sandy, and said, do you know the work of Julia Mossbridge? And I said, no, I don't. He said, well, you should. And I said, okay, fine. And so he sent me a bunch of information on her, and I looked it over, and I said, you're right. And so I contacted Sandy, or he introduced us, and we've been in dialogue ever since. And she said she was going to be in the general direction of New York on the East Coast. And I said, well, you've got to come and let's do something. So that's how the origin, the etiology, if you will, began.
Excellent, excellent. And Julia, thank you so much for joining us as well. I would love to hear a little bit about your work with the Institute for Noetic Sciences and tell us how that fed into your authorship of the book.
Sure. At the Institute of Noetic Sciences, I'm now actually a fellow, which I was previously the director of the Innovation Lab. I was on the science team. And then on July 1st, I became a fellow. But regardless, before I came to IONS out in Petaluma, I had been researching precognition for about 8, 10 years, something like that, or maybe longer. And at IONS, I was able to interact with the science team, which is world-class there. There's 7 scientists on the science team, including myself when I was there. And they are all people who have been trained at high-level institutions, whether corporate or universities and have really, really gone far and yet been told if you're going to study what it is you want to study, you can't do that here. And so these are people who have, you know, people at UCSF, people who came from University of California, San Diego, people who came from, we have one person there who co-founded Pixar and won an Oscar for their computer science engineering. Just a really wide array of brilliant people with fantastic backgrounds, but who said, frankly, I'm not going to play the game I need to play and ignore these kinds of very interesting questions having to do with telepathy or precognition or clairvoyance or psychokinesis. I'm not going to ignore those questions. Instead, I'm going to study them and bring more information into the world about them. And so that's where we congregate at ION. So it had a more social impact, I would say, and a strengthening impact on my work than it has sort of made a shift in my work.
Well, that's pretty amazing. And I do think that there is this, I wouldn't call it so much a conflict, though it may be, but there is this sense in the scientific world that one has to stay in the very old Stoic traditions, and new innovations tend to come very slowly. So yes. I'm glad that you were able to do this.
Yeah, me too. It kind of saved my life, I would say.
that's
made my life much better anyway, so yeah.
So can you talk to us about some of the innovations and the studies that you have been doing that led up to your work in precognition and understanding the full dynamic, or at least a fuller dynamic, of what it means to be a human being?
Sure, yeah. For me, my passion has always been twofold, and I didn't recognize it was twofold until maybe the last, you know, you learn as you grow, but maybe the last 5 years I realized I had two passions. And one is to teach and learn about love, to understand what the power of love and what the subjective experience of unconditional love is and how to access that. And the other is to teach and learn about time, to understand how time flows or events flow in time. And those two have been with me since I was a child. And so my innovations and work has always been around that. So, for instance, the first technology that I produced in 2012 was an app called Choice Compass, where I wanted to help people use their hearts to make decisions. People have a hard time making choices. I'm a very quick choice maker, but people around me definitely would spend hours talking to me about their choices, and I thought if I could make an app where they could listen to their heart, then they wouldn't have to talk to me for hours about their choices. So I made an app called Choice Compass that uses your phone's camera to get your heartbeat, and I did some math comparing the heart rhythms that people had when they were making positive versus negative choices. And then I tested that to see if that was correct, and it replicated, and then it replicated again. So I put that on the market. Right now, Choice Compass needs an update for the iPhone because of a change in one of the functions, so I'm getting that out later this month. But in any case, later in November. But in any case, that was my first piece of technology. And then I worked with the Institute of Noetic Sciences to make an app called PsyQ, P-S-I-Q, which is a free app that's all about testing psychic ability. And I worked with Dean Radin. That was Dean Radin's dream to have that app. And I think we're going to change the name to Psy3 or PsyCubed soon. But in any case, right now, you can find it on the App Store at PsyQ. And that tests three different kinds of psychic ability in an attempt to try to get thousands of people to use it so we can screen for people who are particularly good. So that's another one. And then just recently with the book Premonition Code, we created this, I designed this website called thepremonitioncode.com where you can go and we spent a bunch of time creating a training or testing platform for people So anyone who wants to test or train their precognitive ability can go there and do that for free. And we did that because a lot of people don't know that you can actually go and test that on the internet. And also, there aren't a lot of resources that are rigorously designed to avoid cheating. This one was rigorously designed to avoid cheating. It's not totally cheat-proof, I'm sure. But if someone really wants to test their precognition, they can do it there. And it would be difficult to try to figure out what the future image is that you're trying to predict without some sort of precognitive ability.
Hmm.
So those are a few things that I've been working on. And then
pretty amazing, actually.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, that's the technology. And then in terms of research, I continue to pursue understanding how to really increase the signal-to-noise ratio for precognitive information. So can we hypnotize people and help them be more precognitive? Can we use unconditional love to help people be more precognitive? Can we use different kinds of music or sounds? So really exploring that space.
Wow. Well, that's really wonderful. Mitchell, would you like to comment or bring
sure.
in a thought regarding where we are right now?
Absolutely. A point of interest and some parallel between Julia and myself. I am not a scientist as such whatsoever. Maybe a social scientist, but not certainly a hardcore, objectively based scientist. And yet, as a child, really teenager, I was fascinated with parapsychology and telepathy and the like. And as I've told Julia, I was so taken up by it that I decided that that was going to be my thesis in college. And the only reason I was going to study psychology so I could prove the existence of God through the presence of this idea of one mind that we were all participating in, and we could communicate through such things as telepathy, and because we were all sharing this one sensibility that was all of us, and we were all sort of plugged in, sort of the way cells are in a human body, and they're part of something larger that they do not necessarily, probably don't see, but maybe sense. So that was just something that also attracted me very much to the work of ions in the first place, and of Julian in particular. And where I come from as a therapist, Catherine, is very much looking at the way the brain is involved in keeping us alive moment to moment. It's got a job to do, and that's to keep us going so we can have the life that we may want. And as such, I see that telepathy and precognition and reading the future are all ways that are part of our natural, organic human potential and are means of keeping us alive by seeing into, you know, what we call the future. It shares something in common with some of the indigenous dream cultures from South America, from the Amazon and Africa. And these are ways that I believe that have worked and kept certain groups and tribes and clans alive over the course of many, many millennia. And these skills have been lost in our rather westernized, materialized culture. And I feel that the work of ions and the work of Julia is helping to bring it back. So I wanted to bring that to the New York public, especially at these times of a lot of diciness having a lot to do with global warming and not knowing really, it's like the rug is being pulled out from under us psychologically and emotionally in so many ways. So to be able to access that part of ourselves that can then access this thing we call the future, which is, you know, it's a little abstract if you think about it, this linear notion of time, it looks like that's just only one small sliver of the whole picture. So these are the reasons I wanted to bring Julia forward and have a public conversation.
That sounds great. And so I would like to go a little bit deeper into that conversation as well, Julia, with regard to your book, The Premonition Code, The Science of Precognition. how sensing the future can change your life. So what is time and what is precognition? If time is real, how can we know the future?
Yeah. What is time is...
good question.
It's one of those questions that you can't answer in 5 minutes or at all, really.
Give it a try.
I'll give it a try. So I'm going to give several different definitions because that's really what we have, you know. So we have the everyday definition of time is the thing that you measure by looking at your watch or your iPhone or your Android or your clock, right? Mm-hmm. So that's really our everyday definition of time. And that time, as much as we hate to admit it, that time skips around, right? That time, it's 12 o'clock, oh wait, now it's 2:30, oh now it's 4. That doesn't move in any kind of flow. There's moments where you're aware of it and there's moments where you're not, right? There's another kind of time that's conceptual time, and this is the time that we're taught, and this is the time that flows evenly from one moment to the next and is always ticking by and has some kind of absolute value. No one can actually point to that time. No one experiences that time, or very few people, maybe Tibetan monks, experience that time. But probably not, because they have a different experience of time generally. But we say that it exists. And the clock, and a physicist might say, well, at least for the clock it exists, because the clock is evenly going from one moment to the next. But then when we talk about physical time, we talk about what the physicists are supposed to be studying, including, you know, space and time and elements in space and time. Then we have a kind of time that goes in both directions in many circumstances. Many physics equations can be solved for in the positive direction, plus t, or the minus direction, minus t, minus direction, I mean the reverse direction, minus t. But in high school, when you learn physics, at least in the States, students are basically told to ignore the solutions to the equations that are for the minus t value. Because even though they work, the teacher generally says, we don't experience that in real life, so we'd throw it away. So that's interesting. That's an interesting fact that can get people to start thinking that time only has events going in one direction. And then there's the time that seems to stand still when it comes to moments of insight or intense moments of awe or feelings of emotional dread. Strong feelings can make time stand still, subjective time. In moments that are special or anomalous throughout our day. And uniting those is really trying to understand the relationship between all of those, physical time, subjective time, conceptual time, and clock time. Uniting those is the job of many people who study time perception and also those who study precognition, like me. In terms of what precognition is, it can be thought of in many different ways. I don't want to describe how it works because we don't understand how it works, but I can tell you the empirical results, and then you could talk about how it works. So the empirical results in the laboratory are that an event that is decided by a random number generator in the future are tied statistically, events that are decided by a random number generator in the future are tied statistically to specific events that come before the random number generator has made its choice. So I'm just going to give an example because that was a little abstract. A person sitting in front of a computer screen who knows that their job is to sit there and have their heart rate measured while they look at pictures, just before they look at a picture of a plane crash, their heartbeat on average will have a different response than just before they look at a picture of a pair of shoes. In other words, emotional versus neutral images or experiences are differentiated before that experience is shown and even before the random number generator has decided what to show. And so these kind of results, I mean, there's a whole array of that kind of experiment, but these kind of results are what we call precognition and what we say there's a disconnect between this idea that events in the future cannot be known until we get there, and the actual statistical results. So what precognition is essentially, it's almost as if, and this is a metaphor, so this isn't the mechanism, but it's almost as if information from the future is leaking backward in time. Or it's almost as if you're reading your future mind. You know, when you see the picture, you're reading your future mind. Something like that.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating. And I would say of all the different ways to measure time, the clock is the most artificial. Because, you know, it just sort of imposes a schedule, you know, time to work, time to lunch, time to go back to work. So it doesn't really have a relationship to our reality in an integrated way, at least from my perspective. So I was wondering if you could sort of look at this from the perspective of brain perception. In that, is it our brain and how it functions that interfaces and sort of spreads things out so that we can manage it and comprehend it, but things might actually be happening much faster? Is that a reasonable question?
Every question is reasonable, it seems to me. So it's not a question that I can answer. I mean, but it's a reasonable way to think about it, I would say. I sort of think that maybe things are happening simultaneously. So when you said faster, I almost would say sort of, I think the question encapsulates my working hypothesis, which is that everything that has happened, will happen, or is going to happen exists outside of space-time and exists to some extent in space-time, as Einstein showed with special theory of relativity, or at least his results suggested that. So those things exist, those events exist, and what is navigable is where you are in relationship to other events. Mm-hmm. So when I was a child and I was reading about this stuff, I had this dream that time was like a room, and the person who was sort of narrating the dream showed me that there was a chair in the room, and if you wanted to avoid the chair, if you didn't want to walk in the chair, into the chair, you had to know it was there. You had to know ahead of time before getting to that part of the room that the chair was there. That's what our eyes do all the time. They tell us essentially what's in our future as we walk forward, right? Mm-hmm. So precognition, it's like a different kind of vision. And it doesn't have to be visual, but it's a different kind of sense that tells us as we walk forward in time what might be there, what are the probabilities certain events, and that gives us some kind of information that we can use to avoid or go closer to things, depending on what we want.
Great. Just one thought when you were speaking, when you were saying that everything already exists outside of space-time, and in this confines of space-time, things are sort of spread out over whatever that is, space-time. So to me, that sounds a lot like what religions say. Do you find that I'm not saying that that is what you're saying, but that there seems to be a kind of, you know, scientists and the scientific community seems to be very much against actually saying that there's something religious or divine about this concept that we have of space-time reality. And I was wondering if you thought that there was any indication of what you've studied that there is some kind of divine order.
I don't know how to test for divine order. To me, that's not a scientific sort of question. I think when you start thinking about divine order, it's more of a question of what does it feel like? And I could say in my own life, it feels like there's some, I feel strongly that I have a relationship with God. Mm-hmm. And I feel strongly that, you know, I have a friend who says there is a God and it's not me. And that's the level of, that's the level of how much I know about God. Like, okay, great. I feel connected to God. It's not really my business what God is. But in terms
sorry
of
for laughing, I'm understand. Just enjoying the perspective.
Yeah, it's really, it kind of is actually freeing perspective. It's like, it's not me. It's not my business. So I'm just going to live my life and have my relationship with God. But that could be considered sort of anti-intellectual. But that is how I feel, because I'm an empiricist. I don't know how to test for that except for my own experience. In terms of anything that exists outside of space-time, I think what you're referring to is this idea that that there is more than what we see. There is more than what we experience to the universe. And I think that is what you're sort of referring to as an idea that is consistent across spiritual traditions and religions?
Well, to me, it sounds very similar, just different languaging. So I was wondering if you saw any correlation there.
Yeah, I mean, there could be. I feel like it's a trap. I feel like it's a trap to start trying to apply scientific principles to faith or to religious principles. It feels like ends up being a justification of religion, but I feel religion is and spirituality are justified by the people who have those beliefs. I mean, they're human cultural beliefs. And so it feels almost like religion and spirituality can appeal to science to say, please validate us. But that feels weak. I'm not interested in doing that.
Okay, curiosity. So
but I'd like to bring something up here, if I may, in that regard.
Yeah.
That is the work of Fritjof Capra back in the 1970s, in his work, The Tao of Physics, was bringing forth certain principles and mathematics from physics that he felt were describing some of those phenomena that are described in practices such as Tai Chi Chuan and Qigong, these ancient Taoist practices, as well as in even Zen sitting meditation and some of the breakthroughs that different practitioners would have in their understanding of the universe was beginning to get a bit fleshed out or understood through certain principles he was finding in quantum physics. So there is this relationship. Gary Zukav did the same thing, and the Dancing mm-hmm. Wooly Masters. There is a history of an interface between these two. And,
sure.
It depends on what type of inquiry and type of scientist a person is as to
that's right.
how open or not they are to that kind of inquiry.
Right.
Okay.
I'm not invalidating the way other people have thought about it. I just find my
sure.
relationship with God really private and not at all empirically testable.
Okay.
Sure. No, it's understandable.
I understand that completely, and certainly doesn't change my perspective either. But I wanted to talk to you about a little bit more about your book, The Premonition Code, The Science of Precognition, How Sensing the Future Can Change Your Life. And it's that part that I would like for you to talk about, how sensing the future can change your life. Because what that says to me is that there is no definite one future, that maybe there's some flexibility there that we can come to a greater understanding through this sensing process.
That's certainly how it seems. And there's, it's interesting. In terms of physics, there's evidence for both conclusions. There's evidence for the future being fixed, which is the special relativity inspired idea of the block universe of space-time. this idea that everything in the past, present, and future already exists and nothing's changeable. And then there's quantum mechanics, which says, which seems to demonstrate that events are stochastic or probabilistic, and in fact, you can't predict the future. And yet, quantum mechanical experiments recently have demonstrated retrocausality, or seemingly sending influences from the future into the past. So there's a complex story to be told, but psychologically, it's very clear that people feel best when they have the experience of being able to shift their futures. And that is what the experience is with precognition. So when you are a person who has a lot of precognitive dreams or precognitive compulsions, which are just feelings that you need to do something and you don't know why, and then later you find out that it was really important, or someone who has lots of precognitive visions or waking experiences, it becomes, there's two ways to go about things, and they're very different. And one way is, oh, I'm helpless. I've dreamed a horrible thing, and now it's going to happen, and there's nothing I can do. And that makes people generally fairly depressed and miserable. Or there's the, wait, maybe I can do something to shift this. And because that does seem to work sometimes, that tends to make people feel more powerful and more at cause in their lives. And so in the book, we talk about the latter, because that seems to be the more psychologically healthy way to go. And the part that I find, besides just basic psychological health, is that as you practice precognition and you sit down and you make it part of, like, it's almost like a meditation practice. You do it for 10 minutes a day and you practice it. We give give one of many approaches to practicing it. And ours involves using the website to do it. As you practice it, what you find is you do change in this way where you start to feel connected to yourself over time. And it's a really beautiful, it's a wonderful feeling. It feels like your future self, let's say your current self right now, Catherine, could look back at your self yesterday and could literally send a message saying, hey, you know what? Sorry you spilled that coffee, but actually it ends up being a pretty good day. You know? You know, and it starts to feel very different to live your life, because you're participating in your life with all of your different selves, and you're observing your life with all these different selves at different times, and you're communicating, and it feels very connected and not lonely, and really whole. I think it integrates people. So that is the piece that I'm most impressed by when people do this practice on a regular basis.
So I would like to respond just how I'm experiencing. I've had a lot of these precognitive experiences, you know, just spontaneously, and I don't have any control over it. So certainly I would like to be able to cultivate that more. So can you give us some sense of what people, using your website, using your book, but even if in this moment somebody wanted to start down this path, what is the process to cultivating this sensitivity to precognition?
The prophet said that truth has declared, I am not hidden in what is high or low, nor in the earth, nor the skies, nor a throne. This is certainty, oh beloved. I am hidden in the heart of the faithful. If you seek me, seek in these hearts. I am hidden in the heart of the faithful. If you seek me, seek in these hearts.
نظر آ جانا پھر جب تو نظر آیا مجھے
Right, so forget the website, forget the book, just in this current moment. The very first step would be to be present right now in your body. And being present right now in your body, it sounds paradoxical because when you talk about precognition, often people think they have to sort of mentally go off into the future and leave their body, travel somewhere else, get the information, come back. That's exhausting and it doesn't work. So what tends to work is being present right now, like you have an address where you can receive information. So you plant your flag in the present moment, and then you're available to receive information from the future. And that's a different, I call it in the book, reversing the polarity. Normally we are used to sort of going out and fetching information and bringing it back. It's this active sort of yang process. And this is really sitting back, here I am, letting the information come to you. And it's a making friends with this part of ourselves that for some people has been trying to knock on our door for a while, and for others we're already good friends with it, but that's a super conscious, which is this part of ourselves that is not part of our conscious mind, but that has information that can guide us and can process much more information than our conscious mind can, and then can deliver answers that are not always right, but can deliver opinions to our conscious mind, and then our conscious mind can sort it out. So it's really developing this relationship between those two parts and not disavowing any part. So the practice would be to sit. If you're wearing glasses, make sure you can see the edges of your glasses so that you know you're in the present moment, sort of in the middle of your head, in the back of your head. And to accept any kind of images or sounds or smells or feelings that come to you as potentially tied to the future event that you're trying to precognize. You also need an intention to, if you just sit there and let things come to you, anything could come to you, right? So you need an intention to precognize something. And that's why we developed this method based on, decades of work in the military doing similar things like this. We adapted that method for the book because then you have something called a tag, which is an 8-digit number that's tied to the future event and things like that. So you can get very technical with it and you can get very precise with it. But, with the method, usually the information that comes up in is imprecise, but useful. Mm-hmm. So the first step is being present.
Excellent. Well, that's something that everybody needs to do anyway, I would say.
Exactly.
Because truth be told, even though it's very appealing to develop this precognitive ability, most people are kind of dead to what's happening right in front of their faces, much less what the future is bringing. So it does mm-hmm. make sense that you would ground yourself in a sense of the presence to be able to have that precognitive possibility. Mitchell, did you want to comment about this discussion at this time?
Yeah, sure. I think that this reference to the body that Julia is making is very, very important. In fact, earlier when you were speaking, Julia, about just the whole nature of precognition, and in a sense you could almost ask, where is it happening? What is happening, of course, and where is it happening? And yeah. I just thing, and you said that we don't really know a lot about this whole inquiry, and that's what's so wonderful about your research, because it's really trying to kind of nail it down a bit and concretize it. But I personally think, for whatever reason, is my orientation very much to the body. Yes, you were referring to the experiments done when there is a word or an image flash before us, and, you know, with the random number generator, and we seem to know what it is before it's flashed, and we have a certain like contraction or expansion. Well, that contraction or expansion is happening in the body. So I guess what I would say, Catherine, here is that it's as though our body, as well of course as our brain and nervous system, a form of radar. And it may be happening on the level of frequency. This is just my, you know, somewhat clumsy attempt to understand the phenomenon. And it has a way of reaching out and probably in to this thing we call reality and time, and its senses. So it's not as mystical as it may appear. It's more that we have this highly sensitized type of radar that's built into our biological system that can pick up energy in many different forms, whether it's, you know, one of the things that Einstein said, which I've always appreciated, is the universe friendly? And if the universe is friendly, we tend to reach out and expand toward whatever it may be, another person, an animal, a tree, the sunshine, or we'll contract. And we, you know, go to protect ourselves from what we think might be a threat. So, with that said, that radar part of us may be, which is rooted somehow in our physical body, is picking up on something that's wonderful, something that's possibly dangerous, or even information, you know, that the work of Jude Kuravan. I don't know if you know her work, either of you, but I've interviewed her several times on my show, and she says that the fundamental foundational substrate of all the universe is actually not energy, but information. So it kind of, if I understand her correctly, you know, may lead into that direction.
Mm-hmm. You know, Mitchell, if you don't mind, Catherine, I'd like to say one thing.
Yeah, go ahead, please. Yeah.
Yeah, Mitchell, this idea that the response is rooted in the body. I think you know this, but I just want to be super clear for our listeners.
Sure.
That just because you measure a response in the body does not mean it originates in the body.
Yes.
So if a heartbeat speeds up before you see a plane crash picture, that could be because it originates in the body, but it could also be because there's some kind of extra body information that is received and influences the body. So
yes,
I just
absolutely.
Want to make sure that people understand that distinction. I know
well,
you know
good.
That.
That's good. That's a very important distinction, and I appreciate it. It's as though it's reflected somatically, but that doesn't mean it's originally in what we refer to as the physical body. We, you know, Catherine and I, and a lot of the work we do, we're familiar with the ideas of subtler bodies energy body, right. et cetera, et cetera. So I think that you're going in that direction, Julia.
Excellent.
Yeah, I think so.
We are approaching the conclusion of this program, though we do still have a little bit of time. Julia, once again, give out your web info.
thepremonitioncode.com. And this event with Mitchell is listed on the events page, as is the webinar, and all sorts of other juicy things at that website.
And Mitchell, too, for people to connect with you and all of your broadcasts and 25 years of work, what is the best website for people
to know? Well, there are two of them. One is abetterworld.tv, www.abetterworld.tv, and the other is my name, Mitchell Rabin, MitchellRabin.com.
And I'll put as many links as I can on the Heart of Mind Radio archive page. So if you missed anything, you can check that out. And my email is heartofmindradio@gmail.com. And I think we're probably close to being out of time at this moment, but if you had one or two words to share, Julia, what would it be?
Oh, love yourself over time.
Lovely. And Mitchell?
I'm going to say ditto that one. It's starting now. Don't stop.
Yeah, that was really all-encompassing and wise. So I appreciate that. And so I invite everyone to stay connected to the radio. You know, PRN.FM has a lot of wonderful programming. I invite you to check out all that's here. And I invite you as well to check out our guests on today's program. And just
you know, Kathy, that I was on PRN when it first began. I was on for many years, actually. And now I'm doing my own thing, you know, but I appreciate PRN very much and the work of Gary Null, et cetera. I'm a regular listener myself.
Excellent, excellent. So I appreciate that as well. And I love PRN as I do love WBAI in New York.
Indeed.
And this whole community of people who are caring for each other, uplifting each other, and doing transformative work on the personal level. But I think as we each personally transform and heal, we have that impact on the world around us. So it's all wonderful and it's all good. And we're going to make it. It's not as fearful as people might think. The world is a beautiful place. So thank you so much for joining me today. And I invite everyone to tune in every Saturday at 6 p.m. for Heart of Mind Radio over the Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM. And I'll say bye for now. Thank you.